So in true like non-Highlander form, I'm gonna stand up here and talk at you guys for 15 or so minutes just about some of the history of Highlander before we move on and hear from some of the people who are doing the work on the ground at Highlander today. So thanks for your patience, and it's good to hear and see all of you out there. Is that an okay? People can hear me in the back? Not too loud, not too quiet, good? Okay. So civil rights activist Willie Peacock is quoted as saying, "When you sing, you can all feel like you're a part of one great soul. When you have that kind of unity and that kind of communication, there is nothing the police can do to stop you." Peacock could have been talking about the same story that Guy Carawan, for many years the music director at Highlander Folk School, recalls from a weekend there in 1959. It's a story that combines the use of music as a tool for social change, to build unity, and to show strength in the face of repression. Speaking about "We Shall Overcome," Carawan recalled, "It's amazing what strength this song has. It's just unbelievable sometimes how it can bring people together. One night in 1959, a group of about 60 of us had assembled at the Highlander School. It was the end of a workshop, and we were having punch and cake and seeing a movie. The local police and the sheriff burst in. Well, for an hour and a half, they forced the people, some of them students, to sit in the dark while they went through rooms and searched suitcases and bags. Somebody started to hum 'We Shall Overcome,' and someone else took it up. Then, from a Negro girl, a high school student, Mary Ethel Dozier, from Montgomery, Alabama, a new verse came into being. Sitting there in the dark, this girl began to sing, 'We are not afraid. We are not afraid today.'" This story, to me, captures the essence of Highlander Folk School, now the Highlander Research and Education Center. So I just want to, as we gather for 4 days of discussions and workshops to try to build a left, a socialist left, a radical left, to learn the history and ideas and tactics to take back to our local struggles, I just am hoping that this panel provides, in part, a starting place for how we can most effectively do that. We're essentially undertaking a weekend of radical activist adult education. So I want to take the time that I have to talk about some of the ideas that animated perhaps the most well-known of such institutions in U.S. history, and then talk some about the organizing work that came out of it. And Elizabeth and Andre will add in, and if I'm missing something or you want to add in, feel free to jump in too. So while the school was founded in 1932, Miles Horton came to the idea while a senior in college in Tennessee in 1927. He was paid to organize vacation Bible schools, but quickly realized that what people needed, especially in the South where he was a space to gather and talk about their needs, their daily needs, and how to fulfill them. Enrolling in Union Theological Seminary in New York City the following year, Horton came to work with Reinhold Niebuhr, who headed the Fellowship of Christian Socialists, which was also an early influence on Martin Luther King's ideas and work. This group was trying to change American politics and theology, calling for an alliance of progressive clergy alongside the labor movement. And Niebuhr worked closely with the head of the Socialist Party at the time, Norman Thomas. Niebuhr was the one who encouraged Horton to follow through on his idea for a folk school in the South. And so you start to get a sense of kind of the ecology of social movements that I think is so important to building struggle to win, right? These different people, different ideas, different influences. Horton was also influenced by the work of famed alternative education leader John Dewey on questions of education and how society is organized. So Dewey argued that knowledge and practice cannot be separated. And as long as they are, change, especially radical progressive change, would be unlikely. He also argued that civil and political democracy had little meaning without economic and workplace democracy. And if you're a socialist, right, those ideas are the bread and butter of what we think and what we do. If we don't have economic democracy or democracy in the workplace, we don't really have democracy. We're not really choosing what our world looks like. Horton also took ideas from labor colleges like Brookwood, run by A.J. Mustey, and the settlement houses run by Jane Addams, so right here in Chicago. That history is very much alive. So though these tended towards more urban settings and problems, Horton appreciated, in particular, the settlement house's informality and the dynamic relationship between staff and community, and the arts programs that focused on poetry, on drama, and on music. So he was a regular visitor to Jane Addams Hull House here in Chicago, and he believed deeply in her sense of democracy. And as she stated it, she said, to arrive at democratic decisions, you need to have a bunch of ordinary people sitting around the stove in a country house or store and contributing their own experiences and beliefs to the discussion of the subject at hand. Then you take a poll of the majority opinion of those present, regardless of who they are, and that's a democratic decision, right? So very basic, rooted in people actually discussing, thinking about their world, and then trying to figure out a way forward collectively. Finally, Horton spent a year studying in and with those running folk schools in Northern Europe. It was here that he came to, in the words of his one of his biographers or co-writer of some of his history, Frank Adams. He said, you have to get behind the common judgments of the poor, help them learn to act and speak for themselves, help them gain control over decisions affecting their daily lives. The answers must emerge from the poor themselves, from the people themselves. So starting his search for a suitable location for such a school in the South, he met with the director of the Commission on Interracial Cooperation in Atlanta in 1932, and he was immediately connected to Don West, who was on a similar path. One of those contacts turned them on to the potential for such a project northwest of Chattanooga, Tennessee, in what was then one of the 11 poorest counties in the country, Grundy County. Here they found Dr. Lillian Johnson. She was the daughter of a wealthy Memphis banking family who was interested in the cooperative movement. She'd been a leader for women's suffrage in the South and for temperance. She owned a large piece of property between a mountain vacation destination and a coal mining town, so you kind of can't imagine a better place than to exemplify the class divisions in society. And she built a house that was a local meeting spot for community members from these surrounding communities. And it took some work, they talk about, to convince her of their unusual ideas around education, that it's not imparting ideas to the community, but actually learning from what the needs are and the ideas and the work of the community. But ultimately, she agreed to give them a trial run. So among the many different types of classes, they held a seminar. You can imagine a variety of classes. They held a seminar on how social change was brought about. And these topics were explored by both teachers and students, bringing what they knew to the local situation to the table. And I just want to read an example of one of these, because I think it's great. So to cut through some of the theory, they wanted to try to get at the lived experiences of local people to understand the world in order to change it, right? So they talk about one such situation where Horton was discussing economics. And he asked a handful of students to explain the theory of surplus value. And so an unemployed, and they'd just gone through a huge strike, a losing strike, where a lot of these students had come out of. And so an unemployed nurse who'd brought a basket of onions and bacon and canned fruit to Highlander in order to pay for her tuition, that was her trade, she said, when I was working at the hosiery mill in Chattanooga, we were told that we would have to take a wage cut or the mill would go out of business. Of course we took the cut. About 10 weeks later, I read in the paper that the daughter of the mill owner was sailing for Europe to spend the winter. I suppose it was a surplus value we had produced that paid her way. Right? So cutting through all the theory to think about, right, how does this daily affect people's lives, right? We don't have to make it abstract, you don't have to understand some difficult theory, but you can see right in practice how your labor is stolen from you and distributed upwards. It was this kind of education and subsequent action and organizing that marked Highlander for potential attack. There was an attempted bombing of Highlander, the first of many attacks over the years, and the latest of which people have probably followed and we'll hear about momentarily, from Andre and Elizabeth. But at that time, students and teachers took turns patrolling night and day for the following 2 weeks. And again, this is like this, you see this again and again at Highlander over its 90-year history. And again, this is what's happening at Highlander today, right? It's the people at Highlander that are doing this work to keep everyone safe there. So after a series of losing strikes, state control, and reversal over victories in the county, this led Horton to focus on really broad social movements that he saw as the place needed to wrest larger victories and change government more fundamentally, that it wasn't enough just to kind of confront the bosses, but there were government structures in place that prevented them from actually winning these bigger victories. So really since 1939, this has been central to the mission of Highlander, that is putting energy into education tied to social movements, to broad social movements, trying to figure out how to win real democratic control at all levels of society. But all good things must come to an end. So by 1946, after a series of labor organizing, the CIO, the once insurgent radical wing of the labor movement, was becoming conservatized and moribund. Walter Reuther, the president of the UAW, one of the radical upstarts of the labor movement the decade before, was campaigning throughout the South for his reelection. And when his aides planned a strategy meeting for Highlander, the staff couldn't help but notice only white local leaders were invited. And this was 2 years after the UAW had sent an integrated group to Highlander for leadership development. So they had had these really radical, integrated labor movement, but they were clearly taking a conservatizing turn. And by 1952, Highlander had fully separated from this conservatizing union movement. The CIO was accusing Highlander of housing communists while they purged their union, and Highlander had no interest in towing this this reactionary line. Zilphia Horton, the music director at the time, she was married to Miles Horton, she was speaking to a Montana farmers union, and she said the unions have become so reactionary and so complacent that they've lost their ideals. And so you really get this turn in some ways away from this conservatizing labor movement. And the rift developed slowly over the 40s, especially on questions of racism. And Highlander went the other way, right? Highlander, the question of the color line was a burning question for organizing labor in the South, and people at Highlander understood that you couldn't take on labor unless you took on questions of the most fundamental social divide in the society, the question of racism. So some of the early organizing against racism in the labor movement developed into more sustained civil rights organizing. An early example of this work was the All-Southern Conference for Civil and Trade Union Rights. It was called to counter racism sweeping the South in the decades before, in the 1930s, including the formation of the Black Shirts and other white supremacist groups like the KKK. And the conference passed resolutions calling for outlawing lynching, the death penalty, for seats on grand juries for Black people, immediate and unconditional freeing of the Scottsboro Boys, and a host of other reversals of racist rulings against Black people across the South. And this was the work that Highlander was helping to facilitate. It was one of the earliest and few attempts to make a cross-racial coalition of religious, political, and labor leaders at the time. And the main move to work on civil rights came both from bringing these integrated groups of labor organizers to the school to strategize and organize for union and workplace rights, combined with a realization that union money would not continue to flow, right? As these unions are becoming more and more conservatized and there's this anti-communist hysteria. So at the same time, Horton got a call to set up night schools in the South, in South Carolina. Septima Clark, a former student at Highlander, made her way as the director of education in order to facilitate this work. And in this role, she brought Asu Jenkins of the South Carolina Sea Islands to the school. Gaining money from a foundation to work to promote democracy, Horton spent half a year just meeting and listening to people on John's Island, where Jenkins was teaching reading lessons to residents as he drove them from their jobs in the Sea Islands to Charleston. So they would use these bus rides as ways to do popular education when they had the time and the space, the few minutes they had, the few hours they had. And he had some success, but he wanted to figure out how to institute this program on a larger scale. Sorry. So Highlander came through not to do the teaching, right, but to train the members of the community to go back and teach each other how to read so that they could pass the so-called citizenship tests in order to be able to vote. And I just, you know, there's a long, wonderful history of the civil rights movement connected to Highlander. So there's a lot to be said, and I'm sure a lot of people in the audience can share those stories. But I want to skip to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It was really the last group to occupy Highlander before the state stole it in 1962 and had it shut down and confiscated all the property. So having spent the year leading up to the sit-ins and freedom rides and packed jails, the group decided to join the fight to register black people to vote in the coming year. SNCC and Highlander were under attack. The house was shot up by rifles, with Stokely Carmichael narrowly escaping a bullet during his time at Highlander. The sit-ins had exploded that spring, and SNCC was formed just 14 days after Highlander hosted its seventh annual college workshop in April. 83 students from 20 colleges were there. Septima Clark saw the importance of this youth leadership, and she said, quote, "Our young people have gone out front, and we must run to keep up with them. We must give them our support, but we must not attempt to wrest the leadership from them." Those leaders present included Diane Nash, Julian Bond, James Bevel, Marion Barry, among a host of other people. So you can see these early days of organizing, not stifling that work, but actually holding up these young people doing this work. And they go on to, right, to lead the civil rights movement. That last meeting at Highlander, SNCC members had a rousing debate on whether to focus on elections or to continue the work of nonviolent direct action. It was Ella Baker who helped usher SNCC into being and was at that meeting who suggested the compromise to do both. And of course, SNCC went on to help lead the struggle on these two fronts across the South. So I want to emphasize the importance of the cultivation of this radical ecology of relationships that built the movement. So going back to the early days of the movement, right? Rosa Parks was famously at the school for 2 weeks of training and organizing just months before she helped kick off the Montgomery bus boycott. And she returned a few months after the boycott victory, right? She kept going back, right? This was a space to go, to think, to organize, to strategize, to connect with other people. And she returned to help plan workshops on public school integration and went on to do that work as well. The connections, I think, are deep and they're worth thinking about. So Edie Nixon, one of the central figures planning that Montgomery bus boycott, was close friends with Rosa Parks and her essential boss at the NAACP office in Montgomery. Back in the 1930s, he and Horton, Miles Horton, had worked together to try and organize Alabama cucumber picklers. Nixon had encouraged Parks to go to Highlander, and Parks' close friend helped secure the money for her to go. And had long worked at Highlander in the Southern Conference for Human Welfare. So this is a whole world, right, of people who, this is a regular interactions and thinking about, strategizing about ways forward. And it's this kind of long-term relationship building and connections that yielded trust, shared political projects, and the dedication to building a radical movement for social change in what is, you know, an understatement to say very unfavorable circumstances. And it was a threat of change, right? Not just moral suasion, but these concrete moves to upset the status quo that made change, but also marked Highlander as a target. So I just want to say a word. I'm close to my time here. I just want to say a word about how Frank Adams and Miles Horton talk about this concept. Get to it here. They say, as long as Highlander operated on the principle of moral persuasion, the school was left pretty much alone, except, of course, for the sporadic attacks by special interest hate groups. But when blacks started qualifying themselves through the citizenship schools and in other ways, and black voters started being counted, Highlander came under sustained attack by the states of Arkansas, Alabama, Georgia, and Tennessee. Highlander was helping nourish a political threat. The extent of the suppression of Highlander was a measure of the power of that threat. And so the attacks on the school were great. I'm not gonna, short on time, but needless to say, the state confiscates the school, they rebuild in Knoxville, and then when development comes through and the state wants to bulldoze their headquarters, they move to their current location in 71 in New Market. I'll end just with thinking about some of the educational ideas that motivate Highlander. So it seems there were always debates among the staff and community, and Horton argues this is what kept it from becoming a detached colony. Struggling with real problems of the day, he said, and participation in community life kept Highlander relevant and rooted, right? So it's not a cloistered away from society, let's build our own. It's rooted in kind of the daily struggles of ordinary people. And I think that's central to the work. And I think it's sort of these unconventional standards that we think about, that they hold up people who don't seem like they'll be leaders or seem like they're too meek or timid, as they famously talk about Rosa Parks. But they don't see sort of like the conventional ideas of leadership as the ways forward, right? They think we need to motivate and organize from below. So it's these unconventional standards, namely the belief in ordinary people to organize themselves for changing society, that has animated the work of Highlander for nearly 90 years. As a school of struggle, it's one I think that we need to look to, both historically and today, the work that's being done to help nourish the seeds of rebellion, give space, give time, and aid to facilitate the work of organizing for radical change. So I'm excited to hear about the work since then and the work you all are doing today. Thanks.
How y'all doing?
Good,
I ain't got to repeat. Sometimes in some crowds you got to repeat, but I ain't got to do that with y'all. That's good. Yeah, so again, my name's Andre Kent. I'm on development team. I know it's not school, but anybody know what development means? There we go. So otherwise, I will also be asking y'all for money. not today, maybe individually, but not today. Y'all good today. Talked about a little bit of the history, so we're dealing with 86, 87 years of history. What's the constant is the good work that people are doing, not only Highlander, but the people that we work with, our constituencies, but also the danger, right? So it was mentioned, that there was a bombing at one time. We also was kind of forced out of Monteagle, was also forced out of Knoxville. So that development, they called it urban renewal, right? I mean, what's the difference between urban renewal and gentrification, right? Not that much of a difference. So not only that took out Highlander and made us move to New Market, but also the black community in Knoxville was localized downtown, and that took away a lot of black neighborhoods, including where Highlander was at, and decimated that community and made everybody move east, right? Including, it was mentioned that Marion Barry was out there, Highlander. His mentee, who was my mentor, Avon Rollins, who was also a co-founder of SNCC, his house was bulldozed at the time, and that was a coliseum there, right? So again, and gentrification is a big thing. So the constant danger is always there. Then March 29th, we had a fire. And, said in the booklet, there was a white supremacist symbol that was on there. That white supremacist symbol was also at University of Tennessee, this place called The Rock. So it was a literal rock where people can just paint whatever. And most of the time it's events, something positive. But this was not only a white supremacist signal, was also going against immigrants and refugees. So we're in 2019, right? Where everybody was growing up, people were saying like, well, this is a better day, and what happened was in the past. Well, a lot of these people are my age and younger, right? But with all that said, with the constant danger, we still doing work, right? So since the 70s, again, we moved to Newmark in 1971. We saw, it's like back then, a lot of our struggles are interconnected, right? Because all of our people are interconnected in some kind of way. We're connected by struggle, right? But we're also connected by stories. It's normally a Southern-based thing. I got my politics from my grandfather on the front porch, right? Not by a teacher, my grandfather and my granny, right? And most of the time it was about whoever they complained about. Well, I didn't like either. As I got older, my analysis started to evolve, and now I realize why my granny hated that person, right? This is how it was. They wanted to go say to be saved. She wanted me to know, because she would have kicked me out, right? So everything's interconnected. So we've been, kind of issue we've been tackling, I'll get to some of the programming, is that as time went on, with that interconnectedness became globalization, right? So that's a big issue. And also with immigration rights, a lot of us started that back in the 80s and the 90s. Also LGBT rights, again, all these issues are interconnected. Even if something is like economic justice, it can be broken down into race, gender, gender expression, sexual orientation, language, and all that kind of stuff. And also, it also mentioned that was the We Shall Overcome song. We also have a grant called the We Shall Overcome Fund. It's a way of giving back to black people in that region, which is the South of Appalachia, because that song was rooted in blackness. So we give a grant out to people within the region who want to use art and culture to shift public policy. That's what our methodologies, which Elizabeth will get into later, cultural organizing. So we had two new co-workers since, not co-workers, they are co-workers, but co-directors, 2017. And one is also our first black woman to ever become executive director, Ashley Henderson. So, and the other one is Alan Maxfield Steele, Reverend Alan Maxfield Steele. They came from our board. Alan was our board chair. Ash was one of our members. And they also met at Highlander around 2007 at homecoming, which I'll get to later, right? And they're both in their 30s, pretty young, comparatively speaking, right? And what we saw, that not a lot has changed as far as our change of theory and our mission and everything else, but how do we evolve as oppression evolves and as people are emerging and as oppression keeps on, you have people are stepping up. So we have three slices of work that we refer to as the whirlwind of power. That's not scaring y'all, but sometimes that whirlwind gets people a little riled up for whatever reason. But three slices, right? So again, it's also just piggybacking off of the work that's been done by the September Clarks of our time, before our time, the Miles Ortons, the Don Westes, the Sylvia Hortons, are saying what more can be done that can be added on. And the three are our social solidarity work, movement accompaniment work, and incubating and innovating rad work, right? So solidarity economy work just deals with, you know, how do we shift economic justice in the region, but also keep it to where, like our past was talking about, keeping people of color in that conversation, right? A little bit going to the past, having black and white people in the same room talk about economic justice was dangerous in the 1930s and the 40s, right? This is before even Lovin versus Virginia in 1960s. Now, that's about interracial dating. Just having black and white people in the room was that dangerous, right? Not much has changed. You gotta have people of color in the room talk about economic justice, because we're all being affected by it. And with that, we have several programs. One was called the Appalachian Transition Fellowship, shortened as App Fellows. So again, we're in the South. More particularly, we're in Appalachia. So a lot of us leave, right? People see other cities outside Appalachia as their Mecca because of how the economic situation is. App Fellows is a way to support emerging Appalachian leaders, right, and build cross-sector partnerships across profits, nonprofits, and governments to foster projects, mentoring, and overall economic growth in a just transition from a coal economy. You know, coal was really big in our region, and we're trying to transition out of that in a more just way, right? Next is our economics and governance curriculum. So it's also available on our website, highlandercenter.org, and it started around 2016. It's a way of people coming together in a more participatory way to build strategies, build knowledge, and have case studies. So what has worked in the past? What's working now? What's working in our region? What's also working internationally? We all have our problems, right? But what are the solutions? How can we do that together? So we had a couple of pilot programs for people just like you all, in a more participatory process. Y'all said what was right, y'all said what was wrong, and then we tailored it. So we have a 1 day, 1.5, 2 day, all variations of that one curriculum to fit your needs so you can be more empowered about your lives, your livelihood, and your community. And lastly, also we have our movement accompanying work. So just making sure our people in our region are supported in every kind of way, which is our youth intergenerational programming, our open call workshops, and rapid response. I'll just do a rapid response pretty quick. There's a lot of stuff going on. It can happen anytime. And sometimes we're called upon that outside of our programming work. So last year in March, there was a ICE raid in Hamblin County, which is east from where we at, which was the largest ICE raid in almost 10 years at a warehouse in Morristown, Tennessee. So we just came for support and emphasizing the people that's already there know what they're doing. We're just there for support. And that's all across the board. Also our youth intergenerational work, we have Seas of Fire, which takes young people from all across the region, and they're working on juvenile justice, LGBT rights, criminal justice reform, not reform, abolition, right? Get that right, abolition, right? And also they're working on economic work. So we've gone back to our camp. We had a week camp last year centered around cultural organizing and combining and analyzing Palestinian youth and their struggles with the youth struggles of people within the region. And before that, we had a tour all across the region with youth going to sites that were important to the civil rights movement to talk to the elders at that time. Intergenerational organizing, and Liz will talk about that a little bit later, we all talk about that torch. We all hold that torch together. And that's what Seas of Fire is all about. We also just got through our children's camp, and that's for 6 to 12 year olds. So knowing that social justice and learning it has no age limit, right? And it was also facilitated by, they consider older, but we had team facilitators as well. And they're not just there just for any kind of summer camp that you're probably used to. And sometimes it will turn to actual protesting. And I was protested, so this is how it went. It's a little story. This is about storytelling, so I think I had this shirt on too. So I'm about to head out. I do mixed martial arts. I'm about to go work out. Somebody told me there's like 20 kids marching down. So where our office was, the workshop center is like on the hill. We call Highlander the hill, by the way. So they marched down. So I end up becoming the oppressor, right? So I'm the oppressed, right? And I'm fighting for the oppressed, but on this exercise, I was the oppressor, right? I was the power structure. So they came to me and they had a spokesperson. I did not hold their hand in any kind of way. The spokesperson was a 12-year-old girl, and she told us what was up. So we didn't have recycling bins at the time, and she pretty much articulated, well, how can we fight for social justice and environmental justice, and we don't have recycling bins. She was right, you know, what can I say? Now, I'm not saying I'm the reason for that, but I'm not going to throw my staff under the table like that. So I'm the fall guy, right? And I had it open, too, because y'all also know in demonstrations, when it comes to talking to elected officials, what do? We need two spokespersons, and they have a closed-door meeting. I wasn't going to have that, because they're going to call me out, too. So I had everybody see the meeting, and had a list of demands. And a five-year-old gave me a list of demands, and it was like a paper big as that. And I said, well, I'll adhere to your demands. I'll do the best that I can, right? Hoping, like, man, I hope somebody bring those bins up next week. They don't know anybody else but me. So they say, you know, well, I respect that, and, you know, otherwise we'll be back. And they sung their behinds up until the workshop center, and that was it. Now again, I didn't hold her hand, it was not simulated, I had no idea that it was coming, right? So they organized against me, I just happened to be the fall guy, right? That's how it is. And also we have our Ray Chofield Community Workshop. So again, just talking about how the 2016 election was, a lot of people were, they felt hopelessness, but they also felt a charge to do something about that hopelessness. So Rachel Community was a way to have individuals and groups come to learn about organizing more, but the Highlander way, popular education, language justice, healing justice. And this is our second year. Within that, we made it an emphasis to intently recruit young people, but also people that was in the Black Lives Matter movement. Right, within the region, sometimes outside the region. Sometimes we have people from New York and Connecticut, sometimes in California, right? But again, it's just bit off that energy, right? One of the co-founders of this group called Song said, you know, you have to hold hope and grief in both hands. This is kind of how this work works, right? And this year we added a direct action workshop and a healing justice workshop, because it's not talked about enough, our healing work, right? And our homecoming, that's our big family reunion and workshop, is September 20th through the 22nd. Hope you all come. We normally have 10 to 20 workshops at that time on everything. Sometimes those workshops come out of you all, right? And just lastly, on incubating rad work, we're part of several networks within the region. Something that's like really cool is that to foster rural internet access and broadband access, we built a tower within the hill to have internet access for a 25 mile radius. And it's in a partnership, Southern Connected Communities. And with that, we won a grant from the Mozilla Foundation. We was the only Southern group to receive that kind of money. That's pretty much about it as far as the current work. That's just a lot. I'll be here to talk about it more, but as far as that, that's my spiel. Thanks.
Yeah, hey, I'm not going to try to talk too much because I want to hear from you all. But I think I'm Elizabeth again, the education team coordinator. So the education team helps plan and hold down all the programming, a lot of the programming that Andre was talking about. And just a couple of things I want to follow up on is, like, it's hard to explain. I mean, 87 years of being around, and our work is focused on the South and Appalachia, and the people that work there and the people we work with are from the South and Appalachia. And we feel like that's important because we feel like we are in the belly of the beast. And one of the biggest values that Highlander holds is that directly impacted people have the solutions and need to be the ones leading change. And so that is kind of at the core and center of everything that we do. There's been, I think I want to mention the different history of attacks and loss that Highlander has experienced. So we talked about the fact that the state stole our charter back in the 60s. They took our property, took our charter, shut us down. auction things off, burn down our buildings, and we just reopened it under a different name. So that's why we're the Highlander Research and Education Center now, and it was the Highlander Folk School. Same people, same plan, same work. And this attack that happened in March has been, you know, really intense and traumatic, but we're still here doing the work. You know, luckily we still have buildings on the property where we've been able to make some temporary workspace, and we are, you know, as the book says, we're making the road by walking. And I think a question for me is like talking about why, what does pose a threat? And I think the common thread from the 30s to today, and our work always shifts depending on what the issues are in the South and Appalachia and what the communities in the region are saying they need and what people are needing to come together and strategize around and what they're trying to build together. The common thread in that is bringing people together across issue, across identity, and across geography. And that was what having this, you know, desegregated workshops back in the 30s and 40s was about. You know, in the 90s when globalization was really hitting, NAFTA had been implemented, there was a factory in, down the road that had been shut down, and the corporation had moved the factory to Mexico. And there was a lot of people in the neighborhood and in the communities talking about, you know, well, they stole our jobs, they took all this down. And Highlander took a group, we call it the From the Mountains to the Maquiladoras, and went down, the factory workers from East Tennessee went down to visit the factory that was now in Mexico and meet the factory workers that were there. And they shared their experiences being workers under this corporation and learned that, you know, they were all struggling and suffering under these conditions, and that the root cause was the same, the root, you know, evil was the same. And they started to build relationships and started to bring that back to East Tennessee to organize white people in their communities and workers in their communities against this, you know, general narrative against immigration, and putting it back to the systemic root causes and how those impact the vast majority of all of us. So I think that that's the threat that Highlander poses, and the work that we always do, no matter what the different issues look like or no matter what the current circumstances are. Andre mentioned, you know, that our land in Grundy County, when they took the charter away, was, you know, lost, but it's still there, and a preservation trust opened it up recently, wanting to make it a historic site. So I want to say that on July 31st, we're going to be having an event where we've been organizing with some folks in the area to give that land back, and acknowledging the multiple complexities of land ownership and power around land in our region, but that this is a step of reclaiming what has been stolen, you know, from movement, from people, and also building with some of the indigenous folks in that area to deepen the analysis and understanding of what that means. And we're going to be looking at land justice, land power, and land ownership a lot more. It's been a big issue in Appalachia with coal mines coming in from outside the region, exploiting people's resources, exploiting people's labor. And the movement that the Appalachian Transition Fellowship Program has been designed to evolve is around this just transition framework. And what we've been seeing is the young people in this program are leading a lot of really radical work in our region, so that as we're moving away from a coal-based economy and extractive and exploitative industries, it's not just reinventing the wheel under a new name of, you know, like a, I don't know, I won't use any examples that might piss anybody off, but, you know, it's like they're actually looking at worker-owned cooperatives and workers reclaiming the textile mills that were shut down and reopening them themselves, and looking at what building local food and providing local and healthy food to people can actually look like. So as we're both fighting the system that is and existing under the current conditions that we're all, you know, kind of coping with at the moment, we're fighting within that, but also trying to build what's new. And so we're calling that transformative justice, and looking always at our vision. What are we trying to build? Looking at the examples, you know, that we see from around the world and from other places, and trying to get people together to learn about that. And so that we can strategize and start to build what we know we deserve and what we know is possible, while we're still within trying to tear down this current system that is. So I think that's just kind of like trying to put all of these different threads and stories and from the 30s to today, you know, into a general context. I think that's what we're about. And we do that in a few different ways, but knowing that y'all haven't had a lot of time to share yourselves, I'm wondering if there are folks in the room who've been to Highlander before. A few of you? Yeah. Would y'all mind sharing, like, if who you are and what brought you there and what you were doing? Wow, that's cool. Yeah. Nice. Thanks. And how about you? You said you'd been there as well?
My partner and I, after we were in grad school, before we started working, we did a tour of the country and put pins in the map and went to roller coasters, odd sites, and civil rights important places. So
I want to go on vacation with you. That sounds awesome. Nobody else has physically been there? Or, okay, interesting. How many people we have in the room from the US South? All right, contingent of us, cool. All right, good deal. Well, as Andre mentioned, I mean, we do have our annual homecoming event in September, and that's a good opportunity to come on up and come through. And before we open it up, just like for general discussions and conversation, maybe I'm going to take just a few more minutes and talk about kind of like all these different things that have happened and evolved, like from the civil rights movement and from the work that's going on in Appalachia today that I think is really rad, and being moved by some folks that have come through some of our programming that we've been working alongside for a long time. One thing I want to give a shout out to is Letcher County, Kentucky, and the Letcher Governance Project that just shut down the building of the federal prison that was proposed to be built there. So that was really rad work coming out from young people in Appalachia doing this work. It's a lot of misconceptions about our region and about who people are and how they think and work. And so, but the way that we do this, you know, it's like, so all these things happen and you bring people together and you have a workshop and this is what, so what's the magic, you know, or whatever. And the magic is not us as staff members. The magic is that people come together and people are able to share their stories. And it's about creating a process. We call it popular education, which, you know, originated out of Latin America. And Paulo Freire is somebody that I'm sure a lot of you have heard about. And a lot of the work that Highlander does was influenced by some of the folks that Eric mentioned, and also, you know, definitely from that tradition. Although we didn't know that was what it was or that it had a name at the time, you know, but it turned out that was definitely the same practice. So PopEd is, again, you know, about following the leadership of directly impacted people, about shifting traditional models of sharing information and education from a banking model where you deposit information into somebody's head and then you go back and withdraw it from them later and it's purely, you know, transactional, into a model that's more that everybody's a teacher, everybody's a learner, we've all got something to learn from each other. And when we create a space where people can really build relationships and really talk to each other and share their experiences, they start to draw those connections between, like, well, I'm experiencing this down in Kentucky, you're experiencing this up in Detroit, and we're both having water quality issues, and we're both having these you know, problems coming from this corporation that owns land in both of our communities. That's interesting, you know, like, how can we draw those lines together? What are y'all doing in Detroit about it? Well, here's what we're doing in Appalachia about it. And yeah, it might be an urban place, it might be a rural place, it might be north, it might be Appalachia, the south, but there are commonalities in who we are and what we're experiencing and what are the root causes of this, and we can learn from each other and then build power that way. That's really the root of our approach with popular education. We also believe that cultural work and people being able, as part of that, building your relationship, sharing together, you gotta share who you are, you've gotta share the music you listen to, you gotta share the food you eat, you gotta dance together, you gotta party together, you gotta tell the stories that are about your grandma and all that, you know? And that's how we, like, really root ourselves in who we are and build real relationships that aren't just transactional, you know, and that don't just, that extend beyond like a weekend workshop or just I saw you at this conference, but like really I'm going to be able to call on you when the cops are here knocking on my door. You're going to come show up for me and I'm going to come show up for you. And we believe that cultural work sustains us not just in building movement family, but in being able to stay in and stay strong, and it keeps us resilient. Language justice is another thing that we believe strongly in and are trying to deepen our practice of again after helping kind of start some of this when immigrant rights work was building out in our communities in Tennessee. We were trying to bring together workers who were Spanish speakers with workers who were native English speakers, and we're realizing you can't equalize power and, you know, have people be on the same page and be able to, you know, talk, like have a conversation if they literally can't understand each other. So we started to build out simultaneous interpretation mechanisms so that you have folks who are, all your materials are translated so that they're accessible to different folks. And everybody in the room is able to communicate because you have a translator there who's simultaneously interpreting it so that you can hear each other. So that's another mechanism that we try to bring into all of our work. Intergenerational organizing, like Andre mentioned, our Seeds of Fire program, our Children's Justice Camp. It's all about building capacity and building power for movement stability and longevity. And also, children aren't the future, they are the present. Like, they are totally experiencing all this shit right now. They know exactly what's up. They know exactly what to do about it, and they're ready to fight with us. And so it's just bringing them into the room and hearing from them as well and having them be equal players in the fight. And there's a lot of rad young people doing amazing work in the South and Appalachia where we are, and I'm sure where you all are as well. And did I forget one? I don't know. Those are the ways that we, that probably did. Cultural work. There's like five or six. Yeah. Transitory action research. Yeah, that's another one. Where it's like when you're organizing, you know, you kind of take out of the institutions and out of the academic towers, the ways that we get information about our lives. So it's like helping people learn how to do the research and how to assess data and then put it back out there in a way that really holds folks accountable and helps build strategies for organizing. So those are our methodologies, as we call them. But I'm curious to hear from you all. You know, I always like to hear Highlander stories. We only got two people in the room, so I hope that y'all will come down and see us for sure. I know Andre and I definitely want to talk to y'all as the weekend goes on and hear from you. And we can just open it up now for a discussion and conversation since I think we've got about 30 more minutes left. Is that correct? All right, cool.